Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Always fun to have him along. Certainly, if you have questions, we hope you'll join us as we move along here in the program. And Scott, welcome back.
It's nice to be back on the program, but I am not so sure about abandoning Southern California and Arizona for the last 2 weeks. Boy, it was the weather was spectacular out there, and it was kind of nice chasing lizards and watching the parrots fly over and things like that.
So. Oh, but what about Wisconsin? You know, it's nice one day and snows the next, and then it rains, well, and then it's nice. It's well, that variety.
It's the variety that's important. But I think spring's here to stay.
Yeah.
Things will begin to happen, and once the frogs start singing and things like that happen, I'll be in better spirits.
Okay. Well, we've got frogs croaking and maybe some coyotes yipping. I don't know. Claude in La Crosse County has a question for you. Hi, Claude.
Hi. Yeah, I live back in a coulee in La Crosse County where it's hilly with lots of woods. And sometimes, particularly in the winter, when I wake up during the night, I can hear the coyotes yipping.
Mm-hmm.
And an acquaintance told me that they do that after a kill. And I just wondered if that's what they're doing.
I don't think you can assume that every time you hear coyotes communicating with each other that they've made a kill. Coyotes do lots of yipping and howling and yodeling and so forth just to stay in touch with each other. They're often in a family group or pack, if you want to call it that. And as I say, they can be very vocal. I hear them all the time around my place in southern Dane mm-hmm. County, and I don't believe it has much of anything to do with. They may very well communicate that, hey, I just took down a whatever and come on over and have some.
Got myself a rabbit.
But there are lots of other reasons why they talk to each other.
Thanks, Claude. Harold in Waupaca, your turn. Hi, Harold.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a wood pile out in my backyard, cut wood that I plan to use next winter, but two woodchucks have decided to build a burrow under that pile last fall. Mm-hmm. How do I get rid of them so I don't surprise them when I start removing the wood next winter?
Well, it surprised them in what sense? That you feel if you move the wood, all of a sudden it's the roof over their head gone kind of thing?
Yeah, and they're going to—I don't want them coming out and saying, don't do that.
Well, I don't think you need to worry too much about that. I mean, basically, they're just a big, fat ground squirrel and not—although they might appear a little bit threatening or hostile at times. There's really not much to worry about, but I think if you're going to demonstrate the generosity of allowing them to relocate before you put them in a bad spot, then probably the best thing to do is attempt to catch them in a cage trap and just physically move them to another spot a ways away. Beyond that, your alternatives are going to be as detrimental to the woodchuck as removing the woodpile. Now, if they've, in other words, we're suggesting a gas fumigation cartridge or shooting them or something like that, I think the woodchuck, given the option, would prefer to have the woodpile removed and fend for itself. So that's your call. The reality is...
Will they be out and around in the winter, though, or won't they?
No, not at all. They'll be down in all probability. They've got a deep burrow under the woodpile, and removal of most of the wood isn't going to make a darn bit of difference to them.
Oh, okay.
So,
I really don't mind them. It's just that I want to use the wood next winter.
They're not going to bother you.
I think you should just go about your business and let the woodchucks go about theirs.
Thank you very much.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Harold. Don't worry. They won't bite.
Well, given the opportunity, they might bite. But
well, yeah, if you grab one by
the
tail.
No one ever gets that close to them.
You can never get that close. John in Tigerton, your turn. Hi, John. John, are you there? John, are you there? Well, let's see.
Scott Murray.
Yes, hello.
See, from the logging road back in western China County, the turkeys are doing good.
Excellent.
But how I got through the winter, they say about three things in life. I'm an elderly hunter, and I went to the local library. I got some good books by Hemingway in Africa, and Teddy Roosevelt wrote four good books, plus Robert Rourke. Well, I'll tell you what, that really got me through the winter, and I suggest it. Anybody, whether you're old or whatever, and you're living in an area like I am especially, can really get you through the winter.
Well, good suggestion. And I mean, we're always in favor of reading. It's a great way to educate yourself about wildlife and natural history issues. And between periodicals like the various magazines or Wisconsin Outdoor News and just scads of good books,
well, on, a lot of good
on
books.
Hunting and natural history topics and wildlife ecology and individual species, you can keep yourself reading for a good long time.
Yep.
Good advice, John.
Thanks, John. Roger in Park Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Rog.
Oh, hello, gentlemen. See, before I ask my question, just let me say I really love this program about the wildlife. But my question concerns the fact that I know a guy that works on the road crew up around Clam Lake. And last summer, he was driving down the road in his truck, and he saw an enormous duck pile by the side of the road. And the DNR was there with a bunch of vehicles, and he wanted to take a look at it, but they wouldn't let him. They were waving people away. And what he concluded is that people are hunting the elk up north of Clam Lake because wolves don't leave gut piles. And he's saying that because of political considerations, the thought is that the DNR has decided to blame this on wolf predation instead of really investigating what's going on around Clam Lake with the elk and hunting.
Well,
what do you think of that, Scott?
An interesting conspiracy theory, but sadly it often turns to that in some of these wildlife issues. But the reality is that along that highway, I forget the name of it here. I've got it here somewhere in my file to talk about today, is that one of the big drains on the elk population, which is doing very well, by the way, from start of 25 animals, it's now up to about 130. They're doing very well, but one of the big drains, there is some predation to be sure, but one of the biggest drains is roadkill along that stretch of highway. The elk are getting hit by cars, and people, being people, tend to ignore the flashing lights and warning signs and, hey, there's elk in the area kinds of things, and the elk are getting hit. And if there was a gut pile along the side of the road, my money would be on the fact that an elk got hit, and somebody, whether it was the person who hit it or an opportunist, said, wow, there's a big pile of meat on the side of the road, and then it disappeared that way. But it certainly wasn't a predator that left a gut pile on the side of the road, not a non-human predator. And right on the side of the road like that, the likely fate of that animal was that it got hit by a car.
Yeah.
And I suspect they're very concerned about that highway mortality as a drain on the elk population. What they were doing to investigate, I mean, they may have been looking for information on that they might have gotten from car tracks or paint chips or who knows what in terms of forensic investigation to figure out what happened.
But, or maybe somebody called. Maybe somebody hit the animal, right, and called it in too. That's the other thing.
So it, but I don't think that this is not an issue related to wolves in a case like that.
All right, thanks, Roger. Mike in Seneca, your turn. Mike, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been planning to do some feral pig hunting, and I've contacted some others, and now maybe you can verify this. I heard that the DNR got sharpshooters in there and shot them all. And I lived in southwest Wisconsin, and this problem was primarily down around the Prairie du Chien area and over near Seneca. And maybe you could cast some light on that.
Well, the feral or wild pig problem is a great concern in Wisconsin, and I think that most wildlife managers, including myself, would like to know that the pigs are in fact gone. But I suspect that's not the case. They've certainly been aggressively pursued, particularly over in the west central part of the state, where the hotbed for sightings seemed to be a few years ago. But the fact that the notion that they've been totally removed, given the number of counties from which there were pig reports, is probably a bit unlikely. But I think the idea that there's a great deal of hunting opportunity for somebody like you or me or Larry to just go out and, hey, let's hunt pigs, that's not the case. Many of the landowners have reserved that right for themselves or their friends where they existed. But both the DNR and the USDA Wildlife Services Program have been very aggressive in doing what they can to remove those pigs. I'm not aware of any sharpshooter activity, but I think they were trying to do some live trapping, at least in the past. And because of the destructive nature of those pigs, it would be in everybody's best interests to get rid of every last one of them.
Yeah.
And if you want to hunt pigs, they're all over California, the southern coast states, Texas, and a variety of other opportunities where you can hunt them with almost unlimited opportunity. So I don't believe...
What would be a way to find out if...
First of all, I was... saying thanks for bringing that up. So, Mike, if you've got access to a computer, go to the DNR website, and there's a fact sheet on the feral pig situation in Wisconsin in terms of where the reports have been, what the population status is, and what your opportunities are for hunting. And it closes with a very strong encouragement for Wisconsin hunters when they're afield doing anything else, if they get a chance to take a pig, take the pig.
Yeah,
and that goes for the deer hunting season or the turkey hunting season coming up or whatever else. So, that's. But I'd go to that website and check out their fact sheet and whatever updates there might be on it. And I think that's the best information you can get a hold of.
All right, thanks, Mike. Bill in Lake Geneva, your turn. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there?
Yeah. Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, I was. There was another story on the elk herd on the radio, and it said the wolves took. They took about 5 or 6 young males. Now, why wouldn't they take the newborn or the sick or the females?
Well, in some cases, it depends not necessarily just on the fact that the animal might be old or sick or weak or small or whatever, but in some cases, it's the behavior of certain cohorts of the population that either causes them to wander around more where they're more vulnerable or be on their own as opposed to part of a herd or a variety of other things that might make them a little differentially vulnerable. So there are a lot of factors that go into what a wolf might take.
And a wolf and the males might be more inclined to roam around than the females.
Yes.
So that's, and I wanted to bring up at this, probably a good time to bring it up, because we had the missing cow, the elk, which found after 10 years.
Yes.
What's that story?
Apparently this particular individual was one of the first calves born in Wisconsin to the original herd. And I guess she had a radio collar on initially. This is quite a long time ago. The collar broke away, and they'd lost all contact with the animal, and I think probably felt it was long lost. And then all of a sudden, apparently during this spring's or winter's trapping operations, lo and behold, there she was again. So after a 10-year disappearance to parts unknown, she's back in the fold. So, I mean, that's good news from the standpoint of, holy cow, look how long these animals are surviving.
Yeah.
But animals that may have been written off as some sort of an unknown mortality actually turn up in some cases. But, I think the tendency is to maybe overemphasize the wolves' role in losing a few elk every year. But it's my impression that bears are equally problematic, especially for the calves, and that... It really goes back to one of the major drains, again, being us and that highway.
No.
So, we tend to not accept much responsibility for roadkill to anything, but in fact, that can be a big drain on a lot of wildlife populations.
Thanks, Bill, for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Buck in Madison has a question for you, Scott, so let's go to Buck.
I'm charmed. Thank you both for doing this work for our sweet state, and I have a question for you.
Okay.
So all these birds of large wing migrate, and they go up north, and they get set off by triggers. But I want to know, do the geese ever decide, oh, jeepers, we made a bad decision and we should turn back? Do migratory birds ever decide they made a mistake and go back, or they just decide to tough it out?
All right.
Well, that's an excellent question. And in the case of geese, their advance in the spring of the year is a lot more leisurely than their retreat in the fall of the year. They tend to be more of a direct flight kind of thing in the fall, and they're often constrained to certain areas in certain refuges because of hunting pressure when they're essentially a game bird, a legal game bird in the fall, whereas in the spring there's no hunting pressure. So their advance in the spring is a lot more leisurely and related to the thaw line. But it's certainly possible that if they overfly the thaw line enough and conditions are lousy, that advance line has some give and take and some flexibility to it. So the notion of geese retreating a few miles to where they can find open water or not, whatnot is not unheard of or impossible.
Yeah, but they wouldn't go all the way.
But they wouldn't go all the way up to Hudson Bay, for example, where most of them nest and say, uh-oh, bad move, too early, let's head back. They don't have the energy resources for that, so I think that they're programmed for the best decision for them is to sit tight, tough it out until the weather breaks and then get on with the nesting, as opposed to using all that energy going and coming.
Yeah. Thanks, Buck, for calling. Appreciate it. Bob in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning.
I was sitting in my living room with the lights off on Monday night during the snowstorm, and I was just sort of watching the snow and the late feeders at my feeder, and it was getting dusk, and all of a sudden I saw hordes, and I would say easily I probably saw close to 200 individual birds. They were all robins, and they were migrating north, and they were going literally into the teeth of that storm. And it just made me marvel of the instinct that these birds undergo to relocate and following their ancestral paths and listening. Well, I'm not even sure they're listening to their hormones, but they're certainly being driven by the hormones. And instead of hunkering down and letting that storm blow past them, there they were just plowing right into the teeth of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pretty neat observation, and those kinds of observations of determination or grit or persistence or whatever you want to call it in the animal world is one of the things that attract people to bird migration and other aspects of animal behavior that we can't understand and probably don't have any parallels with in our own behavior.
Yeah. No, we don't. No, that is for sure. And I am a phenologist from way back. That's one of the things that I do enjoy is just watching the progress of things throughout the year. So that lost you.
Well, we're here.
Okay, there you are. Well, at any rate, I'm done, but I thought I'd share that observation with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks very much for calling. Lots of callers online, but we have some open lines. You can get on at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Nick in Green Bay is up next, so let's go to Nick. Hi, Nick.
I got a question. I got a comment. The comment is actually we are hunting on 170 acres of land, and now a developer came in and offered the guy $20,000 an acre, so we were told we got to remove our deer stands and stuff. We're going to buy property from him, but we can't match $20,000 an acre.
Not for hunting purposes. That would be tough.
No, it's really hard on hunters. But now, there's a place called Lily Lake in my area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know if it's open for hunting for turkey.
I simply don't have any idea, but you can certainly call the DNR Service Center in Green Bay and find out easily enough.
Okay, yeah.
What are hunters supposed to do about hunting land? Because it seems like it's all getting bought up for duplexes and condos and all that stuff that is really wildlife unfriendly.
It's been a problem for many years, Nick, and it forces both the wildlife and the hunters out into other areas where there's more competition for space, and it's cited as one of the reasons why there's great concern in the hunting community right now about the retention of hunters as hunters. And it's cited as one of the reasons why some people, especially people who have been at it for a while, are getting out of the sport because they simply lose. Hunters are very much tied to tradition. If you've been hunting a farm for many years, spots the way Larry and I have, it's hard to just pick up and say, let's go find a new spot. It's not that easy.
No, and the thing is I hunt for two reasons. It's fun to hunt, and it's amazing the things that you see wildlife-related out there. Like I had a raccoon walk right past my stand this hunting season, and it was great.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's just, like you said, it's hard because I don't know where to hunt now. I got no clue.
Well, in the southern two-thirds of the state, the options are the DNR public hunting grounds and leased areas that are around, and those maps and locations are readily available at the DNR offices or on their website. As you go further north, of course, I'll say north of Wausau, then you start to get into huge expanses of county, state, and national forest, most of which are all open to hunting, and then the options are greater, but there's also a lot of folks who take advantage of that because it is public land. But
it's hard in Green Bay because there's no areas to hunt.
Yeah, the Green Bay
area
is
close. When you're close to a heavily urbanized area, you really do have to drive a bit. And in that case, it's not a situation where you can kind of go out after supper for a couple of hours to sit in a tree stand unless you happen to own land. Otherwise, you're relegated to a weekend trip or whatnot to get where you do have access.
And just to bring it up, as long as we're talking about it, there were some problems relating to turkey tags this year, too.
Really? I hadn't heard.
You spent a lot of time on the computer.
Well, I was in Arizona Friday morning at the North American Natural Resources Conference, and there were several folks there from Wisconsin, and we started at 10 o'clock, as we were, you know, as everyone thought, to try and get some of those extra turkey tags. And boy, I'll tell you, the frustration level with what happened, which was a complete crash in the licensing system, there were some stressed out people, not only in Arizona, but from what I heard from my friends back here, there were long lines, there were frustrated people. It was a very unfortunate situation, both for the hunters and for the DNR, and I guess for the contractor who was handling the system, which didn't perform very well. So the upshot of it was there was a high frustration level, and very few permits of the some 50,000 plus that were available were issued until I think about mid-afternoon when things started to straighten out. And then for the rest of the day, it was possible to get those permits. I managed to get one over my cell phone from the Denver airport on Saturday morning. And, you know, I think people who wanted the permits did finally end up with them, but it was just a sad situation that so many hours of hunter time and professionals' time were essentially squandered on Friday and probably into Saturday when...
Yeah.
You know, we don't know what the reason was. No need to be. So it was just a sad situation. I think the permits, I meant to go online this morning to see if any were still available. If there are any still available, they're likely for the sixth or last turkey hunting period at the end of May. But presumably they're all in the hands of hunters now who, when they're finally out there sitting there under a tree on a nice spring morning and hear a gobbler, hopefully they'll forget about the hassle that was involved in getting the permit.
And the season starts on the 16th, isn't it, of April?
Yeah, it's the 16th. Yes, I think the 16th is the first. Yes, it's the first of the 6 5-day periods beginning April 16th. They run from Wednesday to Sunday, 6 consecutive periods. And there's a youth hunt just before that runs April 12th and 13th. And, you know, the projections are, the turkeys maybe had a stressful time getting through the winter, but most did. There's been terrific hatches the past couple of years. So you combine all that, I think they're projecting a harvest of maybe 50,000 birds again this spring. That's a lot of dead turkeys.
Yeah, that's a lot of turkeys. Nick, again, thank you. Roddy in Milwaukee is up next. So let's go there. Hi, Roddy.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a question. About a year ago, I was driving home. We live in southeastern Wisconsin, Brookfield area, and a deer was coming across the street. I was watching this fairly good-sized deer. All of a sudden, like a big dog came out and just jumped on its neck and took it down. Now, I wasn't sure if it's like a coyote or a cross between a coyote or a dog or a wolf. And I guess my question is, are there wolf sightings in southeastern Wisconsin? And how concerned should we be as parents or whatever if there's children outside and things along those lines? Or could it be a coyote or a cross between a coyote and a dog or something along those lines, if it's not a wolf, to take down a deer?
So the animal jumped on this good-sized deer, grabbed it by the neck, and simply brought it to the ground.
Brought it down. I was stunned. I didn't know what it was. It looked like something like a German Shepherd or something. I wasn't sure what it was.
Well, that's a very interesting and unusual observation, for
it
one
sure
thing,
is.
Especially in that area. I mean, few people get to see any kind of a predator kill anywhere. Even if you're on safari in the African plains, the idea of seeing a kill firsthand is pretty unusual. But nevertheless, it's a valid question. If it was a dog, you know, the neighbor's German Shepherd or whatever else, it's much more typical for dogs to attack the back end of an animal, to work in groups, and to essentially make a very messy job of taking it down, rather than take the animal down by the neck, as you described, which a wolf might be able to do. In answer to your question, there have been some sightings in southeastern Wisconsin, but they're unusual, and I think most people feel that these are, in all probability, animals that can disperse great distances and are simply passing through. The habitat available in southeastern Wisconsin, it's a real stretch to think that wolves, although they've proved much more flexible than anybody thought, the notion that they'll establish themselves in a human-dominated landscape is a bit of a stretch. A coyote, which are very common in the area you describe, would also not typically take down a deer by that mechanism.
Right.
And they're not a big, powerful animal. And if it was a good-sized deer, as you suggest, that would be a real handful for a coyote, no matter how it was going to attack it, especially if it was alone. So the bottom line, Roddy, I'm not sure what you saw. You know what you saw, but a good-sized deer and a good-sized canid or a member of the dog family like that, to take down that size deer, it would have to be something of the wolf or wolf-dog hybrid kind of size. But whether that was an animal that was temporarily out of captivity or a wild animal moving through, we will never know.
Never know. And it's probably not posing much of a danger to children or...
Oh, no. In answer to your question about whether you should be concerned about wolves or any of these other large animals in southeastern Wisconsin, my answer is no. But, you know, we never use an absolute no. It always pays to be prudent with any risks in life. But the kinds of things that you face in your day-to-day life in southeastern Wisconsin or anywhere else, just in the notion of driving to work or crossing the street or whatever, are so much greater from a risk standpoint than what you face from a wild animal. Don't lose any sleep over the wild animal situation.
And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Lois in Algoma is up next. Lois, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
For quite a long time, I've had a concern about the legal trapping of animals.
Yeah.
I know about the history, of course, of trapping, but I am concerned about the cruel nature of trapping and the fact that it's really not a fair game, you know, kind of activity.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know of any entities who have moved away from trapping as a means of, capturing wildlife?
First of all, I would have to say I'd be remiss as a wildlife professional in not saying that trapping or the use of what I think you're thinking about in terms of traps, like a leg hole trap, for example, have a very important place in wildlife management, not only for, in some cases, management of disease situations or problem populations, but the animals that are captured for many of the reintroductions that people are so happy with, you know, bringing back otters and fishers and martens and things like that to places, or the research that's done on wolves still leading to the successful restoration of wolves in Wisconsin, those animals are all trapped and safely and humanely trapped and handled and released or moved or whatever we need to do with them. So I think it's difficult to make a blanket assessment that trapping is unnecessary, cruel, or inhumane. If you mean are people moving away from using traps to solve everyday problems, then yes, there are some moves around the country. In fact, one of the two conferences I just attended on the West Coast was an international pest management conference, and the Humane Society of the United States representatives made an interesting presentation on an actual business venture that they've launched in the Washington, D.C. area, where they now offer kind of an alternative pest control strategy for people facing difficulties with raccoons in a chimney or squirrels in a soffit, where they do no lethal removal at all. The animals are either structurally built out of the situation or excluded, or they're captured in cage traps, and then the structural repairs are made and the animals are released on site. And if there are cases where there are young and a female, then they're kept together and united and taken care of and released as a family unit. And the largest wildlife control franchise in the country, the Critter Control franchise, has also adopted kind of a, well, I'll call it a subdivision or a new approach too, which is available for people of that mindset.
Sure.
That they call, I think it's called Safe Critter or something like that, where again, they're not doing any lethal control or using traps that ultimately would lead to the dispatching of the animal. So yes, there are some organizations moving toward that in the pest control industry. There's certainly development within the trapping industry of using snares and sets and traps that have always been there's always been a constant evolution in the industry to develop traps that are as humane and as efficient and effective as possible. No one, the trappers included, wants to think about the kinds of things that the visions people have of a, you know, three-legged animal or something, which is a very, it just doesn't happen very much. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge concern, the way trapping is currently practiced.
Thanks very much for calling, Lois. Appreciate it. John in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Well, hello. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
I have a question about what I believe are squirrels and red oak trees. I have noticed off and on over the years that the terminal 6 to 8 inches of red oak trees, of the branches, would be cut off and lying on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And they are cut off because I've checked them, and the cut is starts towards the terminal end, heads towards the trunk, and it is definitely cut and not broken off by wind or twisted off.
Yep. That's a pretty common harvest strategy for some squirrels.
Now, see, and this is in the middle summer that I've noticed it mostly on my land over in Waupaca County and some here in Sturgeon Bay. And it's just generally red oak trees, although I assume to be others.
There are other trees that are hit, too. I've seen them work on elms here on campus, for example, where they'll what happens is that the squirrel's interested in something out on the distant point on this twig, but that's a hazardous proposition. So it's a lot easier, in depending on where you are. Red squirrels are particularly prone to this, but gray squirrels will do it too. We don't have any red squirrels here on campus. But they'll get out as far as they feel comfortable going on the twig, and then it's, hey, let's just nip these off. So they're up in the tree, nip off a bunch of twigs, they're all over the ground, and down they go to get whatever they're interested in. It may be while there's still nuts present, it may be seeds in the case of an elm, it may be something else they're interested in, but that's usually what's going on.
Yeah, I assumed it was gray squirrels. I've seen it both in Waupaca County and then here in Sturgeon Bay, and right where I live there aren't any red squirrels,
yeah.
Although a friend of mine says, he's 2 miles down the road. He says, I got all kinds. You want some?
I'd let him keep them. yes, it certainly in your case then could be gray and probably is gray squirrels.
Yep. Thanks for calling, John. Appreciate it. Jim in Turtle Lake, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Well, hello, Larry, and hello, Scott. I just was wondering if you had talked any on the mountain lions of late. I heard a couple, 3 months ago that you were talking about the possibility of doing some trapping or of other ways of identifying where they might be. And that in the Amory Free Press, which is a paper over in western Wisconsin, I see a nice big picture of a mountain lion that was on the front page.
Mm-hmm.
That was hit in Iron River. We also had a picture in the Cumberland Advocate about 2-3 weeks ago of one that was snapped through a patio door and definitely is a mountain lion. And also the caller about 3 callers ago was talking about possibly a German Shepherd. Son of a gun, that sounds more like a mountain lion kill to me, where he's jumping right on the back.
That's right. I didn't want to bring that up because I didn't want to open a can of worms on that situation. But I'm just assuming that since he apparently got a good look at it, that he would have known a dog-like animal from a huge cat-like animal. But the only animal that came to mind when he mentioned that's big enough and powerful enough and kills like that to just leap on a deer and whomp, take it down, is a cougar. But let's not go there. There's a great deal of talk about cougars now. There has been for a long time. And most of it's centered around the validation of an encounter down in southern Wisconsin near Milton, where a farmer saw the animal and the tracks were verified. They had a blood sample that was genetically determined. Yes, it is a cougar. And there have been some other sightings since. The two pictures that you describe have been circulating on the internet for some time, and both are bogus in terms of relating them to Wisconsin. And both are exposed that way. There's a couple of websites now, and I'm just trying to find the specific website.
So the newspapers got conned.
Well, a lot of people get conned by these things, either cougar sightings, wolf sightings, all sorts of strange animals that are cited as being in places where they simply aren't. Or they may be, but the picture wasn't taken there. So you have to be very suspicious these days, unfortunately, of photographs. And we've talked about this before. It's a sad thing because we get a lot of our information from the public, but an awful lot of what's circulating just can't be trusted. Anyway, if you can get a hold of the most recent edition, the March 21st edition of Wisconsin Outdoor News, there's a good column in there entitled Work Continues on Cougar Sightings, and there's a table that indicates the possible, probable, and total sightings of cougars over the years from 2000 to the present. And I thought the websites were listed here, but I'm not seeing it. Go to the DNR website and fiddle around a little bit on cougars. And there's one site that that describes and discusses and debunks these so-called hoaxes, like the photographs. And there's another site, a very good site now, that has a great deal of information, factual information, on the actual cougar situation in the state. Yep. So they're clearly here now. No one's arguing about that anymore. There are people working on a management plan. There's a cougar working group that's formed of professionals trying to address this. And, you know, there's some good information coming in.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. And let's go to Matt and Hayward next. Matt, hello.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, Scott. It was about 10 or 15 years ago. I was having a conversation over a beer with this retired warden, and I was telling him how I'd heard on the radio Scott Craven was talking about down in Chippewa Falls area that the railroad was reporting seeing this mountain lion.
Really?
And they sent the warden out to look at it, and it turned into a boxer, and it didn't have its tail cropped.
Oh, well, I don't remember that. There have been so many sightings over the years. I don't remember that specific one, but the reality is that when a lot of sightings are investigated, your mind plays tricks. Your mind's eye plays tricks on you. And anybody who's spent a lot of time in the woods, if I sit on my deer stand long enough, I can look at a stump and, you know, all of a sudden that becomes, I'd swear that's a deer head or something like that. So in some ways we see what we want to see. But when a lot of these sightings or encounters or sign or whatever are investigated by someone who knows what they're doing, they turn out to be something else. And if this was a cougar sighting that turned into a boxer, so be it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've spent my whole life in the woods, and it seems like most of the people around this area that report all these cougar sightings and stuff, I don't believe any of them.
Well, but now we actually have one that's been borne out by the kinds of DNA science that we watch on TV on the CSI programs or whatnot. So that's made its way into the wildlife field, and this particular sighting in the southern part of the state, there's no doubt about
it
anymore.
No doubt about it. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for calling. Dini and Mozanie coming up next, but let me remind you, our guest today is Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Give us a call with your question. We have an open line at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Scott, I'm going to be mentioning you tonight. As a matter of fact, I'll be talking with Steve Paulson at an event called Wednesday Night at the Lab on the UW-Madison campus. It's in the Genetics Biotechnology Building on campus, parking right there in Lot 20 right next to the building. We'll be on from 7 to 8:15 or 8:30 tonight in room 1111. That's on 425 Henry Mall. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I'd be there myself, maybe. Except I'm teaching the hunter education class tonight on campus. So,
well, I'll be talking about you a little bit.
Okay. Well, do as you will. I talked about you a little bit at our Master Gardener session up in Dodge County last night. So,
okay.
Turnabout is fair play.
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun. 7 to 8:15 tonight. Room 1111, 425 Henry Mall. Free and open to everybody. Parking in lot 20. If you're in the area, come on by and say hello. Deanie in Mosinee, it is your turn. Hi, Deanie. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I just want to, regarding the elk in Clam Lake.
Yeah.
That's Highway 77 that runs through there.
Yes.
I know you were wondering what highway it was.
Okay.
And also, my understanding was is that those flashing lights work off the radio collars. Is that true?
Lights on the collars, you mean?
Well, off a radio, the lights that are blinking on 77 there, you know, to warn
so,
you about elk.
So that the flashing sign can actually sense the presence of an elk through the radio collar. Well, you know, if that isn't the case, it's a darn good idea, but I can't verify that one way or the other, but I'm guessing some of my DNR colleagues are listening who can, and maybe somebody will call in. There are several ways that those animal warning lights work. Some of them flash all the time, but those have proven to be – people get used to that. Some of them actually have kind of a motion sensor or laser beam that runs down a long stretch of road, and they flash when that beam is broken by anything. But the presumption is that it's likely an animal that may be about to move across the road. Whether they could be tied to scan all the different frequencies of the collars or not, that sounds like a really high-tech issue. I hope you're right, Dee Dee, but I don't know. So we'll have to find out.
Hopefully somebody from the DNR will phone in and let us know.
So, Larry, I feel bad now. Larry misled us at the outset of the program where he said I could answer all the questions. I do not know, so we'll find out.
Well, I go through there about every 3 weeks, and it seems that those lights do flash randomly. You know, sometimes I'll go through there and there isn't a light on. And the next time, the first and second light is on, and the third and fourth isn't, you know. So
well,
I was just curious as to how that works.
We'll see if we can find out.
And if we can't find out today, we'll hopefully get something for the next program, first Wednesday of May. We'll try that out. Thanks, Denise.
Oh, can I ask another question?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a statement. As far as these cougar sightings, I was driving between Hayward and Ashland, and about 2-3 miles north of Hayward, I think that's Highway 63 there, I had a cougar run in front of the car, and this was broad daylight about noon, 1 o'clock. And believe me, once you see him, there's no mistaking him. I mean, it's a single-lane road, and he made it in two leaps. He was huge. And, I mean, beautiful, but... very intimidating.
That's exactly the way my wife describes her sighting of a cougar, that it was on one side of a two-lane road and it made two bounds, one to the center line and one to the other side of the road, and it was gone.
That's exactly what it did.
Yep.
The only thing is it was running alongside the road kind of in the woods, so I caught it in my eye,
mm-hmm.
and I was able to slow down, thank God, so I didn't hit him. But it was just magnificent the way he crossed that road. I mean, just unbelievable.
Hmm. Well, there you have it, Larry. But, you know, still, in all the years we've talked about these things and all the people who you know, kind of surface that say, well, I saw one, so did I, it still baffles me that all these sightings occur, and yet in November we can put almost 700,000 people in the woods. And I don't believe I've ever heard of a cougar sighting by a deer hunter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing.
I don't know where they go during the deer season, but underground or underwater or whatever. But they seem to be amazingly elusive, considering, you know as well as I do, that there are not very many places in Wisconsin that are not seen by the eyes of a deer hunter over the course of that hunting season.
Yeah.
So whether they just keep quiet about it or it just doesn't seem to get back into the network, I don't know, but that seems very odd to me.
Thanks, Deanie.
That's some big country up there, so
it
you
is.
Never know.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Pat in East Troy, it is your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I need your advice.
Okay.
I've had a problem for a number of years on a little badly built porch that allows, for some reason, the chipmunks can get in there. And last summer, I got gave up because the feral cats have all been removed by a kind neighbor, so we are now inundated with chipmunks. And I caught 35 of them in rat traps.
Uh-huh.
And I don't like killing chipmunks. I don't like killing anything, but I can't stand having them on my porch. That means that I can't use it if they're going to.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought a live trap.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't taken it out of the carton yet, but I'm about to. And I don't know when if I catch one in the live trap, how far away do I have to go to make sure he doesn't come back?
Well, the rule of thumb for most small mammals is 3, 4, 5 miles, something like that, just to be sure. And if you can cross a river or some other natural obstacle, so much the better, and maybe the distance could be shorter. But I need to clarify that just a couple things, Pat. Number one, the so-called live trap is probably better stated as a cage trap, which is what it is. It does catch the animal alive, but the notion that that's entirely harmless to the animal is sometimes a little overstated. It's certainly stressful, but they can certainly get banged up and break teeth and so forth in their attempt to get out of that trap. The cage trap for you, from your standpoint, I know you don't like catching them in the rat trap, but the cage trap is going to be much less efficient than the snap traps in terms of how many animals you remove per day or week or whatever measure you want to use. And in addition, it puts a tremendous burden on you to have to relocate them and hopefully find a place where they're not going to just be a problem for somebody else or be released in already overcrowded chipmunk habitat. So this notion of using these cage traps freely and that the animals will all live happily ever after is not as straightforward as it might seem. But tell me about this badly built porch. What is it about the porch that makes it infested with chipmunks?
I have looked everywhere. I cannot find their entrance.
So you mean this is an enclosed porch?
Yes.
It's
screened in and plexiglassed in.
What's the floor?
Concrete.
Well, they're not coming through that.
No.
Well, you know, obviously, logically, there has got to be a hole somewhere close to the size of a quarter that they have access to. And if you can't find it, you know, get some fresh eyes in there and do a meticulous search of every corner, every seam, high, low, and in between, and find out what that access point is. And if they have no access, they can't get in there. It's just, you know, that's the solution to your problem. Rather than trapping on the porch or trying to reduce the overall chipmunk population outside, get somebody in there, a pest control person or one of the wildlife control organizations like the Critter Control Franchise, or there'll be others in the Yellow Pages, and let them find that access for you because it's got to be there.
And, you know, sometimes at night it's easier if you've got a light on that you can turn on inside. You can go outside and, you know, sometimes you're able to see the light coming through. You may have tried that, but...
No, I haven't tried it.
Well, turn the lights on inside the room and then go outside.
Just look for a little beam of light or a point of light, and that may give you a bit of a clue. But, is this a huge porch? I mean, is it like...
No, it's about 6 feet wide and 10 feet long.
Holy cow. Then I just can't imagine that someone who's, you know, sort of familiar with animal issues couldn't find that access point for you and eliminate it. And then you don't have to trap anything alive or dead. Leave the chipmunks outside where they belong.
Yep.
Good luck.
Thank you very much for calling. And Gloria in Pittsville, your turn. Hi, Gloria.
Oh, hi. I like to walk out on the highway. I live on the highway, and we've had a lot of wolf sightings in the area. Do I have to worry about being attacked by a wolf?
Probably not.
No, yeah, I agree with Larry. Probably not, and that's a high probable probably.
Yeah.
They're just, you know, there was great controversy, I think it was last year, over whether the first wolf death of a human, or human death caused by a wolf, actually occurred, and it was way up in northern Canada, and the experts are still arguing about that. You know, if I was walking on the highway, Gloria, there are a lot of things I'd be a lot more worried about than being grabbed by a wolf. just in terms of safety issues. So the short answer is no. I'd be fascinated by the notion you might see one. Mm-hmm. But
we have sighted them, yes.
Yeah, the wolf is going to be... Odds are excellent that the wolf is going to be a lot more concerned about what you might do to it than what it's going to do to you.
Okay.
All right.
I shouldn't be carrying anything like a long stick or whatever. That wouldn't help them.
Well, I mean, if you feel better carrying a walking stick just to be comfortable to maintain your footing or fend off just about anything, then, you know, so be it. But go ahead. But I just don't think you have much to worry about on that front.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Tim in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. Sorry to beat the dead horse on the wolf thing, but about a year and a half ago, I was sitting in my backyard. I live on the outskirts of Eau Claire, and I live right along a creek with a bunch of woods. And I noticed what looked like four fairly large dogs. It was through some brush, so I wasn't exactly sure. I had my camera out because I was taking some pictures, and I was able to maneuver and get a good picture of them as they were passing through. And when we looked at the pictures later, they appear to be wolves. Mm-hmm. They are, I'd put them about the size, I don't know if you know what a wolfhound is.
Yeah.
I'd put them about that size.
Can you send that picture in?
I'm wondering where I would send those into. I got about, 8 or 10 pictures.
Yeah.
Sure, you can send them to the public radio address, I guess, or you send them to my email, which is srcraven@wisc.edu, and we'll take a look. But, you can also submit them. One of the purposes behind the rare mammal sightings in the Park Falls DNR office maintains the records and sightings, and Larry's given me the cutoff here. It's noon. Got to go, but the Park Falls DNR office can help you as well.
Scott Craven, our guest here on the Ideas Network. Talking the world of wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Certainly, if you want to join in, the lines are filled now. The number is 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Scott, Lane Stoll from Hayward is on the line. Lane, hello.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Lane. Glad you could call in. I've jotted down a series of questions for you. Are you ready?
You bet.
Well, first of all, those flashing elk warning lights, are they in any way linked to the collars on the animals?
Yes, they are.
Excellent.
This is a special system that was developed by Washington State to do what we hope will prevent elk vehicle collisions in the Clam Lake area.
Great.
That's excellent.
That's excellent. And could you comment on the contention we made that a major, if not the major, drain on the population is that highway mortality issue?
Yes, it is. It's not the number one mortality factor. Wolves are the number one mortality factor. But wolves, 80% of what the wolves take are bulls.
Okay.
However, about 55-60% of the ones that are hit on the highway are cows, and the cows are much more important for the productivity of the herd than the bulls are.
Okay, excellent. And is that a behavioral difference between the bulls and the cows that makes them differentially vulnerable to the wolves? Or?
Yes, very much so. In fact, what happens is that at about 1.5 years old, the bulls are kicked out of the cow-calf groups, and they're not really adopted into a batch or a group of bulls until they're 3 years old. So there's a period of time when they're most vulnerable to wolf predation. They're more likely to be on their own, yet the elk that are in groups, the cow-calf groups or the bachelor bull groups, they're relatively safe from the wolves.
Excellent. So our speculation there was solid. How about the rediscovery of that long-lost cow? Was that a matter of you saw a tag on her or something? Or
right. She was captured as a calf in the summer of 1996, and a metal ear tag was placed in her ear, giving her that number 26. And she had a radio collar put on her at that time, but it was a special collar that expanded and then would break off after about 2 years' time. And we normally capture those female calves and replace those collars with permanent adult collars, but we've never caught her again. And it was kind of a surprise for us this year. Here's a cow that you know, after 7 years and handling 297 elk through our winter trapping, she finally showed up in our capture this last week.
Darn. Well, that's pretty neat.
And the other one was the gut pile.
Can you shed any light on that? The woman was driving by and lots of vehicles and apparently a big gut pile on the side of the road.
This was in the Clam Lake area recently?
On Highway 77, apparently.
There have been instances where we have salvaged elk. Any elk that's hit on the highway, unlike deer, cannot be taken into possession by the motorist.
Okay.
But we do salvage them occasionally. If there's not enough damage, we'll salvage them, have them processed, and donate to a local food pantry.
Excellent.
But I'm not familiar with any recent episodes of that. The last elk that was hit on the highway was the second week of December of last year.
Okay.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot for calling, Lane. I would one parting question, because I'm trying to head off something that we get asked about quite often, although not today, and that is there still do you foresee a day when there might be a limited opportunity for a few bull tags in that herd?
Well, we definitely have the regulations and season framework and population goals already established in administrative codes. So mm-hmm. The paperwork has already been accomplished that would allow that. The delay on that is based upon the elk herd's growth.
Right.
Looking at our annual growth of about 10-13% a year these last couple years, we may reach the threshold for such a hunt by maybe 2011 or thereafter.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, we were saying 2008, but we've had some curveballs thrown at us by Mother Nature. And so I guess tentatively we may have something as early as 2011.
So that's great. Just knowing that it's a possibility, I think, gets some people pretty excited. So
thanks. Thanks, Lane.
My pleasure.
Lane Stoll of the Department of Natural Resources out of that Hayward area. It was great to have him come on. He's an elk biologist, and obviously he's got the answers there, some of which we didn't have. So it was great to hear from him. Well, I'll tell you what, we've got lots of other callers online, so...
Well, just one thing, because in the lead-in, you mentioned this Wildlife Adventure Field Day at Goose Pond, the Audubon Society program, and you mentioned Saturday. I just wanted to... It is Sunday.
Oh, it's Sunday.
Yeah, Sunday, April 6th from 1 to 5 p.m. At the Audubon Society facility at Goose Pond, which is just north of Madison in Arlington. Mm-hmm. Fairly easy to find, and they've got all sorts of events, kind of family activities, a program on cavity nesting birds, a program on salamanders, frogs, and other critters, some hands-on stuff, and some behind-the-scenes look at Audubon Society management there by Mark and Sue Martin, the resident managers. So something to do this Sunday, but there's tons of stuff going on.
Tons of
at
stuff.
At this time of year.
Good people there with that Audubon Society. I was master of ceremonies for their banquet last week.
That's right.
And it was really a lot of great people involved in that organization. That's for sure. Joe in Jackson County is up next. Joe, hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, every spring, a friend of mine, we go up to Birchwood camping, and we always stay at Sawmill Lake, and we have a female bear, so it's always got a cub. Mm-hmm. We've seen her within a half a mile of the campground, and I was just wondering what was the best way to, keep her out of our campsite, because we're usually the only people in the campground.
Well, I'd be surprised if there's a campsite anywhere in northern Wisconsin that isn't within half a mile of a bear at any given time. So that's just a fact of life. And, the fact that an individual bear may or may not have even made it through the winter, and whether she has a cub or cubs or not, is going to vary from year to year. So I think the advice for anybody camping who's concerned about bears is to just follow some of the basic guidelines of keeping your food protected and not...
Yeah, we keep it in coolers, but you got to turn the switch to open.
Right. So if you're cautious in that regard in terms of primarily foodstuffs that would attract the animals, and then pay some attention to the guidelines of what you do if you see a bear in terms of how you behave and respond. I'm sorry, we're losing you there. But basically, there are some good publications and information available on how to respond to a bear presence in bear country and the advice on how to stand and posture and response and so forth. If you're concerned about it, check out that kind of thing. And I think you can find all of that on links on the DNR website.
Several years back, I was camping in northern Wisconsin in Bayfield County. And we woke up in the night, Jerry Carbon and I woke up in the night to some noise outside, and there was a bear that was, he had moved the cooler, which was plumb full. It was our first day there. Sort of, he was sitting up, and he had the cooler in his lap, so to speak, and he was biting down on the corners of this cooler, and he got mad about that. He was biting on the wrong corner, and then he cracked it, and I mean, that was a heavy wind. And both of us were picking that thing up, but it rolled and rolled across the ground, but it didn't open. And then he came over to the tent, and Jerry was standing up, and the bear stood right up and looked at him. At that point, I had my knife out, not to stab the bear, but to make a new door in the back of the tent.
Door in the tent.
But he or she left, and apparently, the next morning, there was a couple on their honeymoon who had been in a pup tent in the camp right next to ours, and they woke up in the night, and the bear was up on top of their picnic table, eating all their food. And you can imagine laying in a pup tent on the ground. Then you've got the picnic table, which takes the bear up higher, and then you've got this very
big.
They were packing up and leaving.
Mm. Well, so it goes.
So it goes. But, you know, nothing happened. Obviously, you have to be more careful with a bear with a cub. Don't get between him and all that. But Chris in Colfax may have something else for us. So let's go to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Wonderful show. Lots of fun today.
Thank you.
Yes. See, about 3 years ago, I live on this farm. It's not used for animals. It's just crops. And I have a Springer Spaniel named Puppet. And my long-distance vision isn't real wonderful, but he jumped over an animal down in the field, and I thought maybe it was a porcupine, but it didn't really fit. And it sprayed him with something, and he stunk. Well, anyway, I come to find out we have 6 hills of badgers.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm wondering now, they're getting closer and closer to the house all the time. Now I've got one that's about maybe 200 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm wondering, do people ever relocate them, or is it best just, I've been keeping the dog away from them, of course. When my little nieces come out, I don't dare take them. There's really no place I can take them around the woods now. The badgers, they've got, I see they're building all the time. There might be more than that many hills now, but every year there's one or two more hills.
Well, you know, part of that may be the badgers. They're not a very social animal, and they can be kind of a nasty disposition. They're a member of the weasel family, basically a big weasel. And but they do a lot of excavating in searching for ground squirrels and things like that that they're eating. So some of it may be just the animals moving dens from year to year, and some of it may be feeding behavior. So I don't think you have a herd of badgers, but the fact that there may be a pair or a family unit of them there is... It's a curiosity for most folks. I mean, most people never get to see a live badger in the state. Best you can do is Bucky Badger, and that's a lousy substitute for the real thing.
Yes, they're wonderful to look
so
at.
So they're very attractive, charismatic animals. Most people never get a chance to see them. If you can coexist with them, fine. But if it gets to the point that, you know, either the dens are a problem for harvesting equipment or livestock, or you're really worried about a safety issue, although I don't think that's a huge concern, then, yes, there have been cases over the years where you can get some help with relocating them. And I would start out perhaps with the with one of the USDA Wildlife Services offices, both for perhaps some advice and potentially for assistance. I'm not sure what they're doing with badgers right now, but there's an office in Waupun and an office in Rhinelander, and they have biologists all over the state, so that would be the first place that I would go.
Okay.
And the second place would be your nearest DNR service center to see what the local wildlife manager might recommend for you.
They're certainly protected yet, aren't they?
Yes.
Yes, and I've seen one large one and 2 small ones,
mm-hmm.
but I read that they kick out the bachelors, you know, when they're a year old, they have to go find their own abode.
That's why I say it's not likely that you have a, you know, a big colony of them there. They don't tolerate each other very well.
I see, even though they're in the same family.
Doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And, Scott, I'm going to try something here, and let's see if we can hear a sound of spring coming up. That, we'll just wait a second here now. No, I'm just...
I think we must be the spring peeper.
Yeah.
What are we going to hear here? Let's see.
I think we're going to hear...
It's called...
Yeah, let's see here. I was
trying to get past the narrative.
I was trying to get past the narrative.
It's only a few more seconds. I know the narrative by heart. It's almost over.
All right.
There we go.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great sound, isn't it?
It is. Those were mostly spring peepers, the ones that sound like the jingling of sleigh bells, and it was a wood frog calling in the background, as the narrative said. And that's going to be a very common thing to hear, hopefully, over the next few weeks, starting in the southern part of the state and creeping north. It's my impression that it's very much winter-like in most of northern Wisconsin right now. But the singing frogs, for me, you know, the cranes have been making their prehistoric calls, and the robins are around, and there are woodcock painting in my backfield, but it's really the start of the frogs that signals spring, as far as I'm concerned.
Me too. Celia in Delavan, it's your turn. Hi, Celia.
Hi. I have a question about bats. I have bats in my house.
Okay.
And I've had them. I've lived here for 44 years, and they've been there ever since I moved here.
Mm-hmm.
But now they're getting so many that they're tearing the paint off the siding when they come in and go out.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think I've had enough of bats.
Okay.
Okay.
There's hundreds of them.
Well, Celia, I'm both pleased and somewhat surprised that you've tolerated them for as long as you have. You know, most people are sympathetic toward bats, but don't necessarily want to share their home with them. So building bat houses and things like that you put outside that will keep some around is a good thing to do. But bottom line is, a 44-year infestation means that there's probably lots and lots of droppings in there. There could literally be, as you suggest, hundreds if not thousands of bats, depending on the home. And with an older building like that, it could be a fairly major construction enterprise to essentially correct all the access points. So I think this is a large enough bat problem that it's not something you're going to be able to tackle alone. So I think you need to, let's see, you're in Delavan. Check the Yellow Pages or the nearest DNR office and see what you can find for wildlife control contractors who do bat work. And ultimately, what you're going to need to do is have someone who knows what they're doing assess the access. And when things warm up and the bats start leaving your home again to feed in the evening, those entrances will be treated with bat excluders such that the bats can get out but not back in, assuming, you know, the kind of the whole roof isn't porous. If they can be excluded that way, once they are, at that point, the next phase is both construction to seal up all those access points, which could necessitate a new roof or some new siding. I just don't know, but it could. And then in addition, I suspect there's going to be a major cleanup exercise in the attic or potentially even in some wall voids or the soffit to get that long accumulation of bat guano out of there and clean things up and maybe restore the insulation. But I think a colony of that size, you need to kind of bite the bullet here, so to speak, and get it taken care of.
Yep, you sure do. And so,
and that's the process, but you need to find someone in that local area that you can get some references on, that they're doing reputable bat work. Don't let someone come in and say, oh, we're going to spray this or we're going to fumigate or we're going to do this or that. The process is to exclude the bats and then do the structural repairs and cleanup. So,
and good luck.
Good luck.
Thank you very much for your call. Jim in Fountain City, it's your turn next. Hi, Jim.
Hi. See,
thanks for the show and thanks for that audio on the peepers. I can't wait with this.
It did sound good.
See, we were out in Preplo Refuge here the other day, last weekend, and watching birds and things coming through. I saw a bird in all my years of living on the river and being outdoors. I don't believe I've ever seen, and that was a loggerhead shrike. Are those that common, or it's just that I just never ran into one?
No, seeing either of the shrikes, I'm trying to remember which one is more unusual, the northern shrike or the loggerhead, but a birder can correct us on that. But in neither case is a shrike a commonly sighted bird. I've seen them occasionally on my property. My most memorable sighting was actually at Horican Refuge many years ago when I was working on geese, and I was actually chauffeuring Roger Torrey Peterson, the author of the field guide, around, and we had some birders in the front seat, and they saw a shrike. And I remembered, like it was yesterday, the fellow in the front seat, "There's a shrike! There's a shrike! Which one is it? Give me the field guide!" And here Peterson was in the back seat of the car, and we were reaching for the field guide. But in either case, a shrike is a good sighting.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thanks a lot. Did Roger have a...
Well, there was a good laugh over the whole thing. I don't remember which shrike it was. Maybe we never figured it out, but it just seemed a little bizarre at the time.
Don in Manawa, it's your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi, how are you, Scott?
Great.
See, I'm kind of a fan of birds, except one particular brand. I just re-sited my house, nice cedar, and I seem to have attracted... Yes, a woodpecker, and... I sure hate to take care of the problem myself. I don't know if it's legal to do that or not, or I need to contact the DNR, but he's made a mess of my brand-new siding.
You know, Don, I'm inclined, since it's new siding and you need to move quickly, my advice is to bypass some of the scare tactics like owl decoys and balloons and netting and things like that, and progress. If you're relatively certain it's an individual bird, I would call the USDA Wildlife Services office in Sun Prairie, 837-2727, and ask for some help processing a permit, which they handle or will handle for you, which will enable you to legally deal with the problem the way I think you're suggesting. And if the damage is occurring rapidly, I wouldn't waste any time doing that. The stopgap stuff, like the scare tactics, aren't going to give you very quick relief.
Could you give me that phone number one more time?
It's a 608 area code, and it's 837-2727. There's an 800 number in Waupun. You can try that, too, or even start there. It's 800-433-0688.
I appreciate your help.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for calling. Shirley and Prentice, your turn. Hi, Shirley.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I might have missed this. How did you get the blood sample from that Rock County panther? Did you kill the animal?
It was
and then
very,
the
very no, carefully. I snuck up on it, and I no, just kidding. As they were tracking it, who knows what happened? You know, it had a nosebleed, a scratch. I don't know what, but they found a blood droplet next to the track, and that's all they had was a single blood droplet, and it was apparently a fairly interesting story. It was frozen. Of course, it was cold, and the DNR biologist had this one blood droplet that they got onto a plastic bag, and they had a long walk back as he was delicately and carefully balancing this sample that proved to be quite valuable, because they had urine as well, but that didn't prove to be enough or suitable to give them the information they wanted, but the blood did.
Sharp eyes. Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Scott, thank you so much. Boy, the time flew by.
Well, I'm dismayed here. My count, the time did fly by. It was a great show, but my count leaves me a little bit short of what apparently is Pelletieri's record for answering questions on the program. So we'll shoot for that next month.
We'll shoot for that next month. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. He'll be back the first Wednesday of May. Oh, my goodness. The year is flying by. Don't forget, if you're in the Madison area, want to check out myself and Steve Paulson. We'll be at Wednesday night at the lab, giving a talk tonight about radio and science. It's from 7 to 8:15 p.m., room 1111 at 425 Henry Mall in the Genetics Biotech building. You can park for free in lot 20, just west of the old University Hospital building on University Avenue. Park at the top level of the ramp, and you can enter without going up any steps. So hope to see some of you there tonight. It'll be a lot of fun. We'll be answering questions as well. Doug Moe stops by tomorrow to talk about searching for the perfect burger. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.